And our sermon text today is Ecclesiastes 5, 8 to 20. If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter, for the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. But this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. There is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt, and those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again, naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. And what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is a gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. That's the way to enjoy work. According to our founding father, Thomas Jefferson, one of the best ways to ensure the liberty of the individual American and destroy any possibility of tyranny was by cultivating and encouraging small-scale farms and farmers. The government should help and nourish small-scale farms and farmers. So, about us, and I include Debbie and myself here, I'm committed to becoming a gentleman farmer. I tell everybody in our valley, I'm committed to becoming a gentleman farmer. First, I'm learning how to become a farmer, and then later I'll learn how to become a gentleman. Jefferson said about the farmer, those who labor in the earth are the chosen people of God, whose breasts he has made his peculiar deposit for substantial and genuine virtue. Unquote. Talk about idealizing, right? The farmer. Well, he loved farming too. And about Jefferson's ideas for ensuring the perpetuation of the American Constitutional Republic, one historian writes, and I quote, "Rural family life and small-scale agriculture formed the core of his vision. Each man would farm the land he settled and provide for the wife and children who depended upon him. Agriculture represented a morally virtuous endeavor for Jefferson, one that would strengthen the character of the nation by guaranteeing citizens economic independence and discouraging social stratification. Self-sufficient, productive nuclear families would be immune to being bought or bossed by the creditors and landowners who had thwarted democracy in Europe." Unquote. For Jefferson, the small farm represented the ideal of liberty. The small farmer, by definition, was independent, self-reliant, resourceful, abundantly productive for himself, his family, and his community. The tyrant of the major metropolitan centers had no sway over him. Jefferson said, agriculture is our wisest pursuit because it will in the end contribute most to the real wealth, good morals, and happiness, unquote. Perhaps you see now why our present tyranny has targeted the small farm in opposition to big ag, right? To cite just one example, billionaires like Bill Gates and China and corporations like Bayer and BlackRock are buying up farmland in America. Gates has almost 300,000 acres now, and they've been sequestering it from growing food in the name of climate change. That is to halt the emission of carbon dioxide. One of the reasons you pay more for your food today is not only because of Bidenomics, but because less and less food is being grown, creating a false and artificial scarcity in the economy. Big Ag does this in full cooperation with and the sanctions of federal agencies like the Food and Drug Administration, the Department of Agriculture, and the so-called oversight of Congress. Now, it's come to pass that Congress does not oversee Big Ag as much as they override the best interest of the American people. In 1921, the representative from the Soviet Union, which in 1921, at that very moment, was starving the kulaks in Ukraine. Kulaks were the middle-class farmers that owned their own land and produced their own crops. That very moment, they were starving the kulaks of Ukraine in order to force them to surrender their privately held farms. That representative was named Maxim Litvinov. And he repeatedly told the American delegation at the American Relief Administration that food is a weapon. Food is a weapon. Food is a weapon. And he was accusing Herbert Hoover and the American farmer of trying to defeat the Soviet Union by feeding the people of Ukraine. Can you fathom that logic? Don't disturb our trying to starve the kulaks by feeding them. There's a lot more we could give you in background of Ukraine that would be appropriate for what's happening there now, but we'll leave that for another day. Bill Gates would agree wholeheartedly with the Marxist Litvinov. Food is a weapon. And the tyrants who rule over you in America know this and are using it cynically and will continually do so intentionally against you. The oppressors of our present system recoil in horror at Kohala's counter-assertion, that is, this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. Your kings are not committed to cultivated fields. They are tyrants, oppressors, committed to barren and sterile fields. But there's even more at stake here. There's more than the literal sense of this idea of kings love cultivated fields. And that brings us to our message today. 4 points I want to make with you from our text. First of all, dissatisfaction. That's our title today. I toyed with dissatisfaction or discontent. Both are appropriate here. There are 4 situations of discontent, dissatisfaction that he treats of here and tries to dispel. First of all, point number 1, verses 5 through 9. A magistrate not satisfied with his biblical measure of power will turn to oppression and tyranny. Ambitious tyrants are never satisfied with their biblical measure of power, but always seek more. You may remember that we dwelt in the precincts of the temple in our last sermon, high and lifted up. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. Here in the remainder of this chapter, we find ourselves in the outer precincts of Solomon's own government, if you see in a province. And what we encounter here is of a different order than what we would find in the temple, which is God's own dwelling place. And there in the temple, we would expect to find justice and righteousness, but not here. There is intended to be a glaring, distinctive contrast. Here we find the real politique of Henry Kissinger. We find, first of all, the systematic oppression of the poor. That seems to be the story of mankind, doesn't it? The history of the world finds that the strong tyrannize over the weak to their advantage. It's happened from the age of the pharaohs all the way to King George III, and then during a brief window of time, in the age of the American Republic, all men have equal opportunity to thrive and prosper. Now, owing to some of the factors that we just mentioned in our introduction, we are now entering again into a dark night of the soul when we will see again the systematic oppression of the poor, as outlined here by Koheleth. And then number two, there is the trampling of justice and righteousness. The history of our race has been dictated by the maxim, might makes right, not God's right shapes the wise exercise of man's right. No. Justice and righteousness, as understood here, justice is the equitable distribution of reward for good behavior and punishment for bad behavior. And righteousness is the promotion of the well-being and peace of one's fellow man, here in our context. All of that is being transgressed by the magistrate in question, unnamed. But while under David, there may have been a few brief years when the tribes of Israel dwelt in peace, safety, and liberty, with perhaps a measure of this circumstance extending into Solomon's reign, we know that an incipient tyranny was already creeping into Israel. What we read from our Old Testament today, David's tyranny over Bathsheba and taking the lamb from the very arms of one of his great soldiers. Whereas my father, Rehoboam will say, whereas my father laid on you a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions. A true tyranny will be imposed on Israel. A true tyranny. And it's difficult to extricate the people from it. In fact, it's difficult for a tyrant to extricate himself. Solon, the Greek tyrant, said this, "Tyranny is a lofty perch, but there's no way down from it." Sounds like the voice of experience. Tyranny is a lofty perch, but there's no way down from it. Once entered upon, there's no turning back. Israel would progressively become more and more a place of tyranny. Hearken, America. There's no way down from the perch of tyranny once it is ascended. Israel would progressively become more and more a place of tyranny, as do all peoples who neglect God. Each subsequent generation of Israelite would progressively sink further and further into slavery until finally world tyrants on the order of Assyria for Israel and Babylon for Judah would come and put the rings in their noses and the fishhooks into their lips and drag them off to their respective fates. That's how they traveled to Babylon, with rings in their noses, hooks on their lips, and you better keep up. But it doesn't have to be that way. Solomon concludes this reflection on systematic oppression. There's a bureaucracy here implicit in the officials, one set higher than the last. Tyranny is always better organized than freedom, Charles Perguez says. Tyranny is always better organized than freedom with a bureaucracy. But he finishes this section with a proverb of better days that formed the theme for our opening here. But, he says, a strong adversative here. But, in contrast to tyranny, this is gain in every way. A king committed to cultivated fields. A king committed to cultivated fields. Dear listener, contrast the fields of men who are free, who own the land which they cultivate, and stand at risk of losing everything if they fail, or stand to gain great profit if they succeed. That's motivation. Contrast these fields with those of socialist slaves who work the fields on behalf of the collective. Shining example, South Korea exports food. North Korea is in a perpetual state of starvation. How long will it be before we must import food? We already import oil and natural gas when we could be energy independent, too, exporting the stuff. This was true in the days of the United States of America versus the Soviet Union, too. It was true in the days of Solomon as well. A king committed to cultivated fields. A king committed to cultivated fields. As a metaphor for the cultivation also of the liberty and the well-being of the people. It's not an easy thing to achieve. Wherever you see a vast network of cultivated fields, right? Does that evoke America for you? Wherever you see a vast network of cultivated fields, the idea of cultivation here is key. Stretching from horizon to horizon. If you've ever driven through Iowa, Nebraska, eastern Colorado, right, you see a vast network of cultivated fields. You see cultivated complexity, too. Cultivated complexity. They don't just appear from nowhere. There must be peace in the land, for example. And that's one of the prime directives of government, to provide peace in the land. If ever you've seen warfare, you see starvation follows on its heels, doesn't it? There are complex systems that must make those fields cultivated. They must be planted. They must have resources to plant. They must nurture crops. They must harvest them and then distribute them to the people. Joseph is exhibit A here of one who provided, in fact, cultivated complexity for 7 years for prosperity, right? And there must also be a just government and righteous behavior among citizens. We talked a little bit about that last week, where a man's word is his bond, where his handshake is his contract, right? All of these things must be present. Cultivated complexity. A king is committed to cultivated fields. When he does so, he is committed to the kind of cultivated complexity that we just described for you. It's the metaphor for the cultivation of the liberty and well-being of the people. Not an easy thing to achieve. I was listening to a white South African farmer this week. He was describing his country's descent into hunger and chaos. After the rise of the African National Congress, which is Marxist to its core, led by Nelson Mandela, it's been over 30 years now, independent white farmers were stripped of their land without compensation. All farmland was socialized under a Marxist system, and vast numbers of black workers were brought to the land who knew nothing about the hardscrabble techniques of making a hard land prosper. And South Africa is a hard land, but the farmers had made it prosper over hundreds of years and the kind of complexity that we just described. And these workers had no incentive to work for themselves and their families. Year after year of failure has made South Africa an importer of food where they used to export food. But, they have DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. They're proud of that. Independence, cultivated fields, a complex culture of cultivated fields. It's a thing that must be fought for by both king and people, the Lord and his subjects. Even as the Israelites found it much easier to lay down the burden of liberty, along with that liberty when they asked for a king, right? So it seems true of every man that there is the temptation to surrender the risk of failure and success for the security of entrusting it to another wiser bureaucrat, perhaps, who knows better than us. Be it not so with us, brother and sister. Be it not so with us. But liberty and tyranny is not the only theme brought out here. That brings us to point 2, verses 10 through 12. Dissatisfaction or discontent. Verses 10 through 12. A rich man not satisfied with his biblical measure of wealth will turn to greed and vexation of soul. A rich man not satisfied with his biblical measure of wealth will turn to greed and vexation of soul. Koheleth here reflects on the fleeting nature of riches. They are vaporous, especially by those with a nagging, vexed spirit that constantly yearns for more. This is a theme we've heard, and it's a theme that he's going to revisit, right, in a cyclical fashion, as he is with all of these major themes. James picks up on this too. Paul does in Timothy, in the text that we read for you from the New Testament today. He who loves money, he who loves wealth. Indeed, wealth here, at least, is a root of evil, isn't it, under these circumstances? I love the movie Key Largo. In it, Edward G. Robinson plays Johnny Rocco, a gangster. And Humphrey Bogart is the good guy, Frank McLeod. And when asked, what is it you want, Rocco? What is it in the end, all these crimes, these murders you commit? What is it you want? And he can't answer it. It's a philosophical question he's never been faced with. And finally, Frank says what Rocco wants perpetually is more. More. And Rocco's eyes light up and he says, yeah, that's it. More. I want more. This lust for more continues to lead Rocco to manifold crime, including murder. Solomon would nod his head in agreement. But he also unfolds a dynamic of greed here. A dynamic of greed. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. Funny how money buys friends, huh? There's an old song from Prohibition written by Jimmy Cox in 1923. Once I lived the life of a millionaire, spent all my money, I just did not care. Took all my friends out for a good time, bought bootleg whiskey, champagne, and wine. Then I began to fall so low. Lost all my good friends. I didn't have anywhere to go. If I get my hands on a dollar again, I'm going to squeeze it until that eagle grins. Because nobody knows you when you're down and out. In your pocket, not one penny, and as for friends, you don't have any. And when you finally get back on your feet again, everybody wants to be your old, long-lost friend. I said it's mighty strange, without a doubt, nobody knows you when you're down and out. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. But there's a further complexity here. The more wealth one accumulates, the more managers he needs to preserve and, yea, increase it, too. The greater one extends the borders of his estate, the more barns, wells, bunkhouses, ranch hands, barbed wire, horses, tractors, cooks, maids, bookkeepers, lawyers, tax accountants, and a crew chief. The more you need all these things, right, when your estate increases? When goods increase, they increase who eat them. This is the voice of experience by Solomon again, right? Just ask any small businessman. It's true of you as well. Koheleth would understand intuitively this proverb. The way to make a small fortune is to start out with a large one. As he did in the previous set, Koheleth here provides a stark contrast. But sweet is the sleep of a laborer. That is, one of modest means, perhaps, whether he eats little or much. but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. Are tired of indigestion, ulcers, intestinal tract problems, because you're up at night wondering how you're going to make or keep or spend your wealth, huh? Solomon is quite spot on here. Do one of two things. Simplify, for example. Return to something of the simple lot of the laborer. That's the romantic and perhaps easier thing to do. It's not entirely biblical either. It's naive when applied to a one-size-fits-all manner. And sanctify, too. Simplify and sanctify. Commit all your ways to the Lord. Trust Him that as you man up and become an entrepreneur and a manager, perhaps that is your calling, that God will give you the grace and poise to be successful and be righteous. It's more difficult. It's less romantic, but some of us are called precisely to it. Fewer of us, let me put it that way, can do that. But it is a calling. And some of you must answer that calling. Well, Koheleth is not done dealing with the theme of riches. It will come around again in cycle. That brings us to point 3, verses 13 to 17. Dissatisfaction or discontent. A father not satisfied to generously bequeath his estate to heirs will turn to miserliness and selfishness. Laban should have been a poised, sanctified, gracious father-in-law to Jacob and generously bequeathed his entire estate to him. Instead, as we saw in our reading today from the law, he was a selfish, miserly, and short-sighted man, a fool. He tried to cheat Jacob out of not only his wages, which he changed 10 times, but his flocks and his wives, too. Laban becomes a kind of type lurking in the background of this section. All his days he eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. Excuse me. Perhaps that's the inscription on Laban's tombstone. Will it be on yours? Solomon here spins a parable of the risks of venture capitalism, doesn't he? And it turns out that he loses it all and has nothing to bequeath to his heirs. A man takes a portion of capital and invests it in a venture. A bad one, as it turns out, may remind us of some in our own day and time, perhaps Sam Bankman-Fried, right? Of FTX. FTX was that cryptocurrency trading platform. And Sam Bankman-Fried was convicted of 7 counts of fraud and conspiracy. 25 years in prison is what he's earned. U.S. News and World Report says it is one of the biggest financial fraud cases in history. Turns out, Bankman-Fried has lost it all and has nothing to bequeath to his heirs. Capitalism depends on the investment of excess capital, that is, those monies as a remainder from operating expenses, and Koheleth qualifies the money invested in this bad venture as money kept to his hurt, that is, money that should have been allocated in another fashion, but which, when disposed of in the manner indicated here in a bad venture, ends up destroying him. Without saying it outright, Koheleth indicates that this man is a fool. Tempted perhaps by greed or failing to do his due diligence, that is, investigating whether this was a sound investment, right? He frittered it away. Note the poignancy of the situation. He is the father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. That is, the son has nothing in his hand. The son is left without a reasonably expected inheritance. Note the contrast with chapter 4, verses 7 and 8, where a man has riches but no son to whom to bequeath it. Here he has a son but no wealth. The fleeting nature of riches, its utter vaporousness, is underlined again in a segue from a newly begotten son, literally, that is, to the circumstances of his arrival. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again, that is, naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil, that he may carry away his hand. Babies don't come out supplied with a wardrobe and a month's supply of formula, do they? Thank goodness for mom. Likewise, there are no pockets and shrouds, and there are no U-Hauls behind hearses. Therefore, take your measure of your days and be wise. The person who selects our hymns does so with just a good eye for the theme of our messages. I love verse 3 from All for Jesus. Worldlings prize their gems of beauty, cling to gilded toys of dust, boast of wealth and fame and pleasure. Only Jesus will I trust. Take the measure of your days. Be wise. Do not cling to riches. Don't be a Laban. But plan to end well. And if there's a remainder to your wealth, leave it soundly to your son. This will be a constant theme as well. The sum of the matter, that brings us to point 4. Dissatisfaction, verses 18 through 20, dissatisfaction, discontent perhaps. A wise man is satisfied with his biblical lot. A wise man is satisfied with his biblical lot in life and finds satisfaction in his labor and the fruits of it. Now, Koheleth concludes here in this section in what? In despair? Futility? All is empty vanity? Perhaps all is utterly meaningless? No. He will confess that all is vapor, brief and fleeting, since under the sun a man's days are few that God has given him. But nowhere is despair counseled. Nowhere is meaningless counseled to the reader. Solomon concludes that there are two worthwhile things to do while here under the sun. While we find ourselves pursuing the wind, if maybe, right? First of all, he says, relish the sweetness of life while you can. Relish the sweetness of life while you can. These are broken down under two headings. That is, enjoy your work and then enjoy the fruits of your labor. You learn that fast on a farm. You don't scoop out goat remains by despairing in it. We had to bury one of our sheep this week, and it's not a very pleasant matter, but we still enjoy our work. We love the farm. And secondly, relish wisely the wealth you have accumulated. Relish wisely the wealth that you have accumulated. I haven't seen this done very often. More often than not, men are foolish or careless with wealth. I hope that's not the case with you. These two things, relish the sweetness of life and relish wisely the wealth that you have accumulated, takes grace and poise developed over the length of a Christian life, dear listener. You must be much in the text, much at the side of other wise men, and much on your knees in prayer. Seek out Christian men who know how to handle wealth and see how they can do it and do it without eating in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. George Eliot has Silas Marner, if you've ever read that classic work on the miser, Silas Marner. Well, Silas Marner eats in the dark, just like here. I think that Eliot deliberately reprised this. Silas Marner eats in the dark so he can save on candles. Instead, become an entrepreneur who can handle complexity, can handle pressure, and do it with grace and with poise. There are some who can do this. Even then, there is a simplicity, a biblical simplicity, uncontrived, in which all of us can live. Learn to enjoy those fruits without being stingy and selfish and greedy. Share with the needy. Give to the work of the gospel, but do not neglect relishing that which you have. I have a simple encouragement to this recourse here for my next week, and that's cheese. Cheese. Debbie makes great cheese, but it all gets sold over the weekend, and sometimes there's nothing left of it, but there is this week. You know, they say the carpenter's children go without shoes, or I mean the cobbler's children go without shoes, right? Well, this poor farmer goes without cheese sometimes, but not this week. So we're going to assemble a meal here at one night this week of all the produce that we have garnered from our farm and sit down and eat it. And then I'm going to sit down with a glass of wine afterwards and eat Debbie's cheese. I'm going to relish the wealth that we have produced on our farm, taking an exhortation from this text. But even in this, I am conscious by Koheleth's very use of the phrase under the sun, that there is indeed one above the sun to whom I am responsible. I am accountable to him for these things. Our time in drawing near to the house of God last week reminds me of it, right? And it should you as well. It is, as Koheleth puts it, a gift of God. How will I have used that gift given me? How will you have used that gift given you? By his grace, in Jesus Christ, may we hear our Lord's words at the end of all. Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. Let us now come to that place then where we find the relish of simple elements put before us as the body and blood of our Savior in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.